Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Donna J. Nickel on the show. Dr. Nickel is the Associate Dean of Personnel and Curriculum and a Professor of History in the College of Liberal Arts at California State University, Long Beach. Dr. Nickel is also the author of Black Woman on the Board, Claudia Hampton, the California State University, and the Fight to Save Affirmative Action, which traces the unforgettable accomplishments of Claudia Hampton. As the first black woman trustee at the California State University, Hampton led a 20-year fight to save affirmative action during the post-civil rights movement era. A visionary leader, Hampton's strategic leveraging of her soft power to sway trustees, advocate for marginalized communities, and effect profound change from within has shaped the current landscape of public higher education. Please enjoy our conversation. Dr. Nickel, I really loved your book in so many ways, and I don't know if you would agree with this characterization, but one of the things I walked away from the book thinking about was kind of pragmatism in leadership and being pragmatic. Would you say that's an accurate picture of what you were trying to show in terms of approaching these situations where there's power dynamics and Hampton had to figure out how to work through different channels to get projects done? Would you say that's an accurate characterization?
Absolutely. There is a Black pragmatic tradition that gets kind of overlooked and overshadowed by Black radicalism when we talk about approaches to civil rights and social justice. And I wanted to bring the conversation back to pragmatism, because when you're entering spaces where you're traditionally prevented from being a part of, you have to come up with a strategy. And sometimes pragmatism is the strategy. And Hampton is following a long line of Black women who use pragmatism. Mary McLeod Bethune used pragmatism as well when she merged the ideas between W.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. She was a student of both, if you will. And when she became part of the Black cabinet under Roosevelt, she had to use pragmatism. She couldn't go in there making, you know, all kinds of demands for the New Deal and expect, you know, someone, you know, a president to just listen to her just because. And so pragmatism is an accurate description of what Hampton really ended up using.
Yeah. And we'll, at the end of our conversation, when we talk about relevance for today, we'll talk a little bit about what your book can help the, you know, progressive left think about tactics and approaches to achieving goals. But before we go there, I want to talk a little bit about your field and talking about how it's evolved since you've entered academia. So this book is focused on, you know, in a lot of ways, history of racism and sexism in academia. I'm curious how that field has evolved since you started your career.
Yeah, so I started my academic career in women and gender studies, and then moved into Africana studies, and then came full circle back to history. So I think that in women and gender studies, there is definitely more conversation about intersectionality, the intersections of race, class, gender, other types of identity, which has helped the field kind of be more open to different groups of people. Africana studies or African-American studies, there's different iterations, obviously. They all have different titles to indicate different emphasis. But on the whole, the fields have also evolved to include gender conversations, conversations about sexuality, conversations with regards to the carceral state and so forth. And so the fields have evolved. But in one thing that I kind of feel is missing or had been missing is kind of institutional history. A lot of times institutional history is super boring. And so in order to write an institutional history about the CSU, I knew I could not approach it from just straight, here's the first CSU and, you know, here we are today. There had to be some way to hook readers into this wider story. But also, I think it's important for you know, like young people in particular, like, you know, we have the student protests right now. And a lot of times students don't know how the university works. And so an institutional history that can get people interested in how, you know, how these bureaucracies work, it, I think is important.
And I work in a bureaucracy and I know it's hard to get things done. So, you know, sometimes you want to channel the passion with someone that has some insight into how to get things done institutionally. And when you have both those things, then that's how change happens, I think. And by asking that last question about how it's evolved, because I was just curious, you know, both internally within academic disciplines, but how those relate to broader social movements. You know, I'm thinking about all the social movements that have happened since 2007, you know, a lot of the Me Too movement, a lot of the protests that happened during COVID, discussions about critical race theory, all of these kind of, there's a lot of like discourse that's out in the public space. And I was curious also, you know, how that has led to changes in ethnic studies or women and gender studies departments as well.
Yeah, so these fields have always embraced these kind of, I'll call it counterculture types of theoretical frameworks, ways of interpreting history and so forth. But when it gets back out into the public domain and people are interpreting what it means without actually talking to and speaking with the people who teach this stuff or people who created this stuff, it becomes everything and nothing at the same time. You know, I'd always am super critical of folks and women's like students who like to use intersectionality as a way to say, well, me, you know, I experienced this too. And it's like, you're trying to flatten everybody's experience, but that wasn't what it was intended for. And so I think it's really hard once something gets out into the public sphere to, you know, it's whether they call it in literary criticism, intentional fallacy, like what you intended and what the public hears are two very different things. And it puts these disciplines in particular on the defensive, you know? So ethnic studies programs are trying to defend itself, even though we've been in the academy for 30, 40 years. Same thing with women's studies. And it's like, why are we having this conversation about belonging when we've been here? So I think that I think it becomes these kind of dangerous kind of conversations because they're not guided by trying to actually fix things or make things better. It's how can we use this buzzword, you know, critical race theory as a stand-in for, you know, people who don't like white people. And it's like, that's not what critical race theory is, never has been. So what are you talking about? Or to, you know, teach people to feel bad about American history. That's not what critical race theory is supposed to do. It's literally teaching you the impact of like race policies. What are those long-term impacts, you know? And so I would have students who would come in my last year teaching who would constantly say, well, critical race theory is supposed to be teaching us that all, you know, white people are bad. I was like, that's not what it's saying at all.
Yeah.
Quite the opposite. It's saying the systems are problematic, but white people in particular, no.
Yeah. It's so hard once things enter a space and you're playing a game of telephone and then people have ulterior motives for how to describe things. And then you get, and then you spend all your time having semantic discussions with people, you know, about what words mean, and then you lose track of the purpose. Now, your book is included in a gender and race in America history series. How do you think your book fits in with the goals of that broader series?
I think it's well placed. And part of the reason I went with this smaller press, the University of Rochester Press, is because it had this series. Because in a lot of instances, people are kind of forced to pick one or the other. You know, we'll go to the gender series or we'll go to the race series, and we don't look at both. And I have been intentional in my entire career of attending to both race and gender. And so I was actually giving a presentation on Claudia Hampton, my very first one. And the series editor for the Gender and Race in American History came to my first conference presentation and said, you know, we have this press. Yes, we are a smaller press, but give us a look. And it took me a little while, you know, and then I eventually started looking around and said, yeah, that's true. Everybody else is like, pick one or the other. And it reminded me of Kimberly Crenshaw's idea of political intersectionality, where you have to pick one identity over the other. And when you're experiencing, say, you know, intersectional discrimination, you don't know if it's because you're a woman or because you're Black or some combination thereof. It's sometimes it's hard to tease it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the research process a little bit before we jump into the meat of the book. Now, you're writing about the CSU system while being in the CSU system. And it seems, you know, some of the advantages I thought about that were, you know, access to source material, access to, you know, professors or administration that worked with these people. And you probably have the access, even though, you know, it's a little bit back in time. I suspect there's some people still around that had lots of experiences with her that you could access. Are there any disadvantages with conducting research about the CSU system while being within the CSU system?
You know, that's a really good question. I always saw myself as an outsider within the system, you know, because I'm approaching this kind of what Patricia Hill Collins talks about, outsider within. I'm in the system. I got my degrees in the system. I've been teaching in the system for almost 20 years now. I'm an administrator in the system. But I've always had a critical eye about the way things are run in the system. And I think my relationship, because I'm not an insider, because I'm a woman and because I'm Black, gives me a way of kind of stepping back and looking like, eh, this could be done differently, or we can approach this policy with an equity lens. So I think I had an advantage with regard to that, not just because I'm, you know, a product of the system, but because I could kind of step back and be critical of it. I can see there being disadvantages where you want to kind of write a triumphant narrative about the system. But I think, and I hope that it comes through in my book, that I just try to present what happened in the record. And most of my book, probably 90% of my book, was primary sources, whether it was interviews or if it was records, the trustee records. There's not a lot written about trustees at all. So I had to create the kind of analysis, you know, I didn't have a lot of secondary sources to go through.
Yeah.
So I tried to let the...
Is there like lots of board minutes that you, and where you have to kind of read between the lines as well? What are some of the challenges of looking at those?
Oh, that is not knowing the tone by which people were talking. And it wasn't until I discovered, like, three chapters into the book that there were recordings of the board meetings, but that was just the board meetings. It wasn't the committee meetings, any kind of special ad hoc committee meetings. I just had to kind of go with the paper on those. But there were some general board meetings, the ones that were open to the public. Ironically, the very first year that Claudia Hampton was appointed, the year that someone called her using a racial epithet against her, that year was lost. So we couldn't find that one.
That's convenient.
Yes.
Okay, let's dig into some concepts that are important for our discussion. I want to start with power. You know, I read a lot of Foucault in college, and I've got understandings of power from him. I have understandings of power through my reading of more traditional history. I have understandings of power when it related to alternative political philosophies that I was reading about. What do you mean when you're describing power in the book? So we kind of have that as like a starting point.
So in this case, power is really about influence. How do you influence people to either take up the mantle, agree with you, step aside? You know, like, how can you influence people, almost like a politician, to get people to, you know, follow, you know, like, kind of fall in line, if that's the best way to describe it. So it wasn't this kind of blunt type of power that Claudia Hampton used. She used a lot of social intelligence and social skills in order to eventually have enough power, build up enough capital to tackle issues, particularly when it came to gender. So for the about the first 10 years on the board, she almost exclusively dealt with race issues. And it wasn't until about that 10-year mark when she started to really delve into gender issues. But that was because she needed to build the capital in order to be trusted with regards to gender issues, because there were other women on the board who were deemed as too feminist and too abrasive. And she knew she could not address gender discrimination in the system with the approach that these other women used.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of stuff that I've read about how Harvey Milk approached dealing with the city council in San Francisco and some of the tactics that he used. The other important concept that I want to talk about is public good. I know in a lot of different, there's a lot of different disciplinary meanings for what that is. I'm most familiar with like what it means in economics. But mm-hmm. for you, how are you using public good in the context of this book?
Yeah, so you're right that a lot of discussion about public good has to do with economic perspectives. And mostly what was happening in the CSU before the 1960s, well, during the 1960s, the system doesn't get created until 1960, but there's campuses all the way to the 1800s. But for the most part, their view of public good was really not was more like public interest. Like, how do you make sure that the money is well spent? And in this case, when the 1960s come and the students are protesting at various campuses, they're reframing that understanding of access to the university, not through a fiscal lens, but from an identity lens. Who has access, not how much can they pay in order to have access? So that's the real critical difference here. It's like, when the California Master Plan was created in 19, and they made the deal with regards to who would get admitted to what type of public institution, it was all about cost. Everything was, the UCs would take the top one quarter of high school graduating class, the Cal States would take the top one third, and then everyone else would go to the community colleges. So about two thirds of students all had their start in the community colleges because it was cheaper.
Yeah.
This had nothing to do with quality of programs, institutional fit for students. Everything was about money. And so when the 60s come along and the student protests come along, they're saying, no, it's not just about money. It's also about whether we have access because we pay into taxes too, but everyone should have an opportunity to attend.
Is California unique in creating these categories or goals with, percentages going into specific institutions? Is that something that makes it unique in California? Or in your research, are there other, state university systems that employ similar tactics?
Well, New York would probably be the closest because their system is on par in terms of size and complexity as ours. But ours was the first that came together and delineated what type of student went to what type of institution in terms based on their high school graduation rates and admission scores.
Okay.
So we're pretty unique.
Gotcha. And were we also unique in the lack of race and gender not being included in the plan, or were there other states that thought about that as an aspect? I mean, obviously it's 1960, so, we can kind of assume some things about how people saw the world. But you talked about the deficiencies in the 1960 plan. We can talk about 1973 and updates, but can you talk a little bit more about the 1960 piece of legislation and why it was deficient?
Yeah, so the 1960s plan was actually the brainchild of Clark Kerr, who was the chancellor for the UC system, essentially. And he started to get worried that the Cal States were growing faster than the UCs by campuses. And so there were, especially after World War II, there were a number of, in a 15-year period, there were 8 CSUs that were created and maybe 1 or 2 UCs. And so Kerr was just thinking ahead, like, oh my gosh, if they keep growing, they're going to encroach into our territory, which is research. And so he went to Dorothy Donahue, who was part of the California legislature, and verbatim gave her the language to create the California Master Plan. And it was kind of sold to the public as a planning document. But what it actually did was it broke up the kind of foothold that the CSU was having in terms of growth. It was slowing that down. And it also was to reaffirm that the CSU, the community colleges and UCs would have three distinct missions. So the UCs would be research, the CSU would be professionals, and the community colleges would be the trades. And so all of the institutions, plus the independents and the privates, came together to create the master plan. And out of that plan came the California Post-Secondary Education Commission, which was a planning unit that would plan for years in advance what education, higher education, would look like in California. It was dismantled in the 90s, early 2000s it was dismantled by Jerry Brown for fiscal reasons. But going back to 1960, part of the deal in order to get this plan off the ground is that each system had to agree to have their own either board of governors, board of regents, or board of trustees. So this was the first time that the CSU would come to bring all of these disparate campuses together under one roof, and they would have some control over their affairs. And some is important because the UCs are written into the California Constitution as a public trust, which means that they get fiscal support from the state, but they don't have to deal with the state giving them that much oversight, because they wouldn't have to rely on the state to tell them what to do. But the CSU, because it was created through a statutory provision to create teachers, to help develop our pool of teachers, comes under the State Board of Education. So it's all the CSU to this day is still very dependent on the state legislature and the Board of Education for fiscal control as well as day-to-day operational control. Those differences in the systems impacts the system, all of them to I can't talk till today.
Well, you're going through a lot of complex stuff here. And and that's one of the things when I was reading, because I didn't really, before reading your book, I didn't really understand the different, supervisory institutions that manage each of these systems. And obviously, that changes how you look at, tuition hikes potentially in some ways. And What confused me in that chapter was why Clark Kerr saw it as kind of a zero-sum game between these institutions, as opposed to seeing it as like, we're just educating a broader populace. I guess he was advocating for his particular fiefdom within this kind of like feudal system where you have these different groups competing for both students and public money. Is that the correct way to interpret his actions here?
That's absolutely correct. He was looking to make sure he shored up legislative support for the University of California. And he would do that by making sure that the Cal States wouldn't keep growing.
Yeah.
If they were to grow, they were going to be very limited in what they could offer students.
I see. Well, I have to take this opportunity for you to talk about how amazing my alma mater, San Francisco State, is. Can you talk a little bit about the creation of the Black Studies Department in San Francisco State?
Oh, yeah. Oh, fun. Real fun. So San Francisco State obviously is unique because it's where the very first Black Studies program was established. What a lot of people don't know is that it was established basically through a co-curricular program called an experimental college, where, there weren't Black Studies programs until these students decided to go through experimental college and start offering courses on miseducation of the Negro and things like that. And these were non-credit courses. And it grew in popularity really, really fast. And because of that, the students said, well, hey, we got a lot of interest. Maybe we should have a Black Studies program and institutionalize something formally. And so the campus decided to hire Nathan Hare, who was a professor at Howard University, to come in and write the plan to create the first Black Studies program. But the trustees were hemming and hawing about doing this, you know, even though curriculum is supposed to be the purview of the faculty. It should not be, according to state law, it's the faculty who's supposed to have governance over it. But the trustees weighed in because they started to get nervous, you know, about Black power, and, you know, and they were nervous about students getting radicalized through a Black studies education. And
this is simultaneous with a lot of the stuff that's going on in the Black power movement in Oakland and Sacramento and different places, correct?
Yes. So Black studies is really the intellectual arm of the Black power movement. And so you have the Panthers in Oakland, they're active. Some of them are even instructors. George Murray, for example, is a TA in the English department at San Francisco State. And what happens is, because San Francisco State goes through so many presidents, they go through like 7 or 8 of them in a 7-year period, people are making promises that they can't keep. And what most people don't know is that in order to get a new academic program, you have to go through the trustees eventually. And the trustees were hesitant. They didn't know what this new thing was. And then the students were making all of these demands at the same time. And so what happened is the campus approved the proposal for Black studies. But the trustees were like, nah, we don't want to get into this. Plus, there was a big old fight. There was a fist fight between the Black Student Union and the ASI, Associated Students, who had control over the funding, the co-curricular funding. So all of those things come together. So you have the Black power movement, you have the fist fight, and then you have the trustees' hesitance, all kind of coming together at the same time. And the students realized that there was no plan to actually fund the faculty and the classes for Black studies. And that's when they go on, that's when they start the strike. So it wasn't that they didn't get approval. They got approval at the campus level. They did not get approval at the chancellor's office and the trustee level. And because when you don't get all of those approvals, you don't get any funding. And so when they realized they didn't get any funding, they were like, oh, we're going to take over the campus.
Yeah. I've witnessed when I was, I was attending San Francisco State in the 2000s and mid 2000s. And, you know, I saw all sorts of legacies of a lot of student action on campus, even a student take over a building, kind of like we saw at Columbia. That was over, I think they took over the building, if I remember correctly, for a $500 tuition hike, which at my point seemed extreme. But, you know, it's that campus has a long history of student activism, and being in those kind of club rooms, as I was in a campus club while I was attending, you know, we were right across from the BSU, various kind of left-wing student clubs. And it was just it's a vibrant place. If you haven't been around San Francisco State, it's a wonderful, vibrant community. I'm going to kind of switch gears here, and I want you to hopefully explain the difference between non-discrimination and affirmative action. And I think, you know, there's some useful concepts that I think help people understand some of the topics we're going to talk about.
Yeah, so non-discrimination is essentially this idea that you will eliminate all remnants of discrimination against people based on their race, their gender, national origin. You won't prevent them from, in the case of university, you won't use those statuses as a barrier to them getting into the institution. Affirmative action, on the other hand, is where you purposefully and intentionally go out and try to recruit people from those particular groups so that they can be included into the university. Mm-hmm. So one is kind of passive. Non-discrimination is just don't keep people out. And affirmative action is do a little extra to help people get in.
Yeah. Well, it seems like when I was reading, I was thinking in my head, this kind of feels similar to, like, in particular, what's going on with drug laws, where you have like decriminalization and then you have legalization. And like, sometimes decriminalization is like a softer route to take for a political leader, but has much more like opportunities for blowback and problems emerging. Whereas, to take a definitive stand for something and legalize it, it requires more work on the front end, but you can avoid some of those obstacles. Is that a fair kind of comparison to both what the terms mean, but also potential issues with them?
Yes. And then I think what happens is because people mix up the two or think that they are almost two sides of the same coin, but they're not. They think that non-discrimination supplants or takes the place of affirmative action. And they're two different things. And so in the case of the CSU, they didn't have either a non-discrimination policy or affirmative action policy when the system was created in 1960, and didn't get a non-discrimination policy until 1974, and didn't get a student affirmative action policy until much later.
What this was my first time hearing it. What was the 4% plan? And can you talk about some of the responses to the development and implementation of affirmative action?
Yeah, so the 4% plan was basically there was a second iteration of the master plan. Every 15 years or so, there is a new update to the master plan. So in 1970, they did it in 73 because it would take 2 years to get it fully off the ground. In that plan, they created a special admit provision for up to 12% of your entering class could be a special admit student, meaning, you know how we have the A through G eligibility
Yes.
requirements necessary. Well, if you're short one or two of those eligibility requirements, you could be admitted conditionally through special admit, and then you would be offered services to help you kind of make up for that missing one. Say you missed 1 year of foreign language or 1 year of math, you can make it up and enroll concurrently in that course and start your freshman year just like everyone else.
It
But
seems
what
like it
happened?
gives admissions departments some flexibility to address people with different circumstances. Is that part of the
That's
reason?
it. That's exactly what it was designed for, because at the time, the people who were involved in the second iteration of the master plan were much more focused on equity and diversity. You know, you have some of the first African American folks elected to state legislature, and Willie Brown and Mervin Dimely, and they're all on the committee for this. And so they recognize that you might have some students who are low income, who are tracked into classes because of their identity that would not make them eligible for the CSU. And so they said, well, one way we can work, you know, give them equal access is to do the special admit. And so they gave up universities up to 12% of their entering class could be part of this program. Most of the CSU went to what was called 4%. They never went over the 4% threshold. And so it got implemented and it was pretty successful for many years in helping students get admitted. And these students, a good majority of them graduated. What started to happen that you see in probably about 2005-ish is some campus presidents stopped, they discontinued the practice. Part of it had to do, there were a number of competing reasons why this was happening. One, the funding that would be necessary to give additional remediation was starting to dry up. So if you were short a couple eligibility requirements, the CSU would have to come up with the money in order to make sure you got, the extra tutoring and things like that. Well, EOP started to, the Educational Opportunity Program started to kind of lose support and funding. So instead of admitting them to your university, you would rather them go to the community colleges and then transfer over. Most of the time, most people never transfers. Though that's been very unsuccessful. Transfers have been very unsuccessful in the state. But the second reason, and probably a little bit more insidious, is that some campuses really believe that these students, that there were some campuses, and I'm not going to say any names, but some campuses began to pursue Hispanic serving institution status. And what was happening is that the big share of students who were coming into these with special admit were Black and Latino. And some campuses did not want that to happen. And then other campuses just didn't want the Black students to come in because they wanted to increase the numbers of Latino students so that they could get the HSI funding from the federal government. So there's a lot of kind of reasons why it's kind of fallen out of vogue, but it's still in place. It can still be used.
How did this book change your perspective on the legacy of Jerry Brown?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that he was a fiscal conservative guy just from what I had been reading. I just didn't know the detail of how he would say he supported affirmative action, and then he would go right around and do the exact opposite in terms of funding policies.
What do you ascribe that to, that kind of duplicitousness in terms of, I mean, is it just a typical politician trying to please both sides, or what do you ascribe that difference to?
I actually ascribe it to a bias against the CSU. And why I say that is because the UCs didn't experience the same kind of cuts to their budgets that the CSU did when it came to affirmative action implementation. And then Jerry Brown, it felt like a sleight of hand, because he would fund EOP programs, you know, the college prep programs that would help students get into the university, but he would not support the faculty and staff hiring affirmative action programs that would actually help the students get through the university. So on one hand, he looks like he's helping students by raising the budget for EOP, but EOP is not his creation. EOP existed well before he got there. And then, yeah, you know, then he would do things like say, hey, CSU, I need you to cut your own budget. It's like, what?
Can you connect this to another? Sorry, we're going to get to Hampton in a second, but there's just so much interesting history here of the CSU system, and then larger things in the state like Proposition 13. Can you connect what we're talking about to Prop 13 and how that relates?
Yeah. So as Jerry Brown is kind of not funding programs in the CSU, particularly affirmative action, you have the Proposition 13. It's, what year is that? 78, I believe it is.
I think so.
So it's this idea that it's to bring down property taxes on a whole on anyone who's purchasing, who's been in a home, and the people who have been in a home, their taxes would get cut. And then the folks who are getting new builds would have to deal with the market fluctuation of taxes. What this does, though, is it, when you lower property taxes, you lower funding to public education. And so at the same time, Brown is cutting support to the CSU, there's an overall state budget cut because of the passage of Proposition 13. And so, you know, tax rules end up having these wider state tax rules impact the system in really profound ways.
Okay. All right. So it's finally time for our protagonist in this story, Claudia Hampton. Before we talk about her background, which will be my next question, I want you to just explain what a CSU trustee is and does, because I think this is going to be a large part of our discussion now. And to be honest, I know what a school board member does. I know what some, you know, city council folks do, but a CSU trustee, how does it differ from other kinds of governing boards?
So in a lot of ways, they're similar because they have oversight responsibilities. But compared to like a school board member who would often be voted into office, the trustees are appointed by the governor. And so oftentimes these were used as political patronage positions. You know, so, you know, folks will say to me now, well, Newsom's putting his own people into on this board. And it's like, well, all of the governors did that. He's not special.
That's the job.
That's the job. So they will appoint various people to to the board, and they have oversight responsibilities for all 23 campuses. They're responsible for convening any type of search committee for the chancellor, all the presidents. They can hire and fire if there is a dispute about something on a particular campus. If it goes high enough, it's almost like the Supreme Court. If it gets up to the chancellor's office and then goes to the trustees, the trustees can be the final arbiter. And so they do things like approve, engineering schemas for buildings. So stuff even at that kind of granular level that you're like, what? Why are they, who are these people in order to be able to do this?
They have the knowledge to be able to accurately assess something like that.
Yeah, most of the time they don't. These are laymen and women who, by virtue of being connected to this governor some kind of way, gets the appointment. So the qualifications, there is no set of qualifications for the job. What you have to do is you have to serve on a committee. I believe they have to serve on two committees. And so they'll go to the committee meetings and then they'll make decisions and then they'll go to the general board meeting and then make votes. Some trustees are active and engaged. Some trustees you never hear from or know anything about. It's very rare that the public knows anything about who they are. They can make decisions. Like if there's a student newspaper that writes something that they don't really like, the trustees can come in and snatch funding for that newspaper. So they have that much control and power, really.
Yeah, they've got big sticks. Let's give some background on who Claudia Hampton was and then how her appointment as a trustee came about.
Yeah, so Claudia Hampton was originally from Chicago and she was a school teacher there before she moved to California. And so she taught in LA Unified School District for a number of years, mostly in East Los Angeles with kids who were learning English as a second language. But because she had some administrative experience in Chicago, she got an appointment in LA Unified as the Director of Schools and Community Relations Office, which was an office that was set up because of the 1968 McCone Commission after the Watts Rebellion in 65. And so it was like the only office that actually came into existence from the McCone Commission. And her job was to go in and be the bridge between the public, particularly with parents, and the school district. So she would go in and she would make sure that principals were adhering to the rules to have PTA meetings. If there was any kind of fight or disagreement with, say, for instance, the NAACP or the Anti-Defamation League, she would keep the district apprised of those sort of things. And then she had the power to go in and write reports against uncooperative teachers or principals and so forth. So that's her educational, education was part of who she was. And then, she had her degrees in chemistry and physics, and then she got a master's degree and her doctorate degree in education from USC.
And then how did her appointment to the trustee, how did that happen? It's an interesting story. I would love to hear it.
Yeah. So she always talked about having a lot of luck. And in this case, what happened is she was an active member of the Los Angeles chapter of the NAACP, and she was on their education committee. And so a woman by the name of Verna Canson, who was the West Coast regional director for the NAACP, called all the presidents of the NAACP in California and said, "Hey, we got a meeting with Ronald Reagan's education secretary. I need you guys to come with me." And so the LA chapter president couldn't attend. So he sent Claudia Hampton because, best fit, given that she worked in LA Unified School District. So she went up with this group and it kind of bum rushed him. He was expecting Verna Canson and he ended up getting like 12 other people and a man by the name of Alex Sheriffs. And so over the course of a year, Claudia Hampton and Sheriffs and others would meet in different places all across the state. And it was basically kind of a vetting process for her. you know, just asking her questions like, well, what would you do with this race scenario? What would you do here? Sort of thing. And eventually, Ronald Reagan's like, why you keep going out of the office and traveling up and down the state to sheriffs? And he said, you know, I've been meeting with this little group that went from 12 down to basically one, which was Claudia Hampton. And so what happened is sheriffs got, when Reagan was getting ready to finish his second term, sheriffs got an appointment as the vice chancellor for academic affairs in the Cal State system. And he asked Ronald Reagan to appoint Claudia Hampton to the board of trustees. She was totally surprised. She had no idea that this was happening. A lot of people had no idea what was happening, quite frankly. And she did meet with Ronald Reagan and they had, you know, a couple conversations. And so I guess he felt comfortable enough, you know, she had been vetted for a year. So he kind of knew her politics. And so she got appointed in 1974 as the first Black woman trustee.
You talk a lot about her, one of her strengths being her preparation ability. Can you kind of go into that a little bit and talk about what made her unique in that way?
Yeah. So what was unique about her is that she knew that people didn't know who she was, and she could almost feel that it was like, this is I'm unwanted entity here. But I have to, now that I'm here, I got to figure out how to be effective. So for her first year, she didn't say anything. She just observed. She watched where there were gaps. And so she knew she could jump onto the education committee because the majority men on the board had no interest in education issues. They were concerned about budgets and buildings. So that was one of the first things she did, was she just quietly watched everybody. But the second thing she did was she realized she had to trade votes and get on the good side of the powerful trustees. And so there was a man by the name of Charles Luckman. And Luckman had been on the board. He was the longest serving trustee. And he was super powerful, very influential, mostly because he was a world-renowned architect. And so she would trade votes with him. And so if he wanted, you know, something to be 10 feet or 6 feet, whatever, she would go along with Luckman to kind of let him know, to signal to him, I'm cooperative. That eventually, doing that enough times, eventually led to her starting to offer to play hostess for their informal telephone network. That's where all the backdoor deals were happening, but she was locked out for over a year until she decided to play hostess. And so she started to invite the guys over to her house and she would cook dinner for these, really the white male trustees. There were some women on the board, but there were very few, and there weren't any other men of color on the board when she first got there.
One of the things I really loved about the book and the way you approached the chapters about Claudia Hampton's tactics was breaking down her various strategies. I just love that as kind of like a conceptual frame for how to look at it. And then you could kind of look at essentially Claudia Hampton's toolkit for how she approached power and getting things done. For you, what was the most interesting strategy that she employed?
I think the long game strategy, you know, where she would make some unpopular votes in the beginning in order to reap benefits in the end. So in the book, without going through all the detail of that particular strategy, you know, when she was faced with being caught in the middle of a fight over the presidency of Cal State LA, you know, she had to be really nimble, to say the least. And, you know, she made some actions she front-loaded some things, meaning she supported some policies, you know, like she used some of her capital in order to shore up support that would reap benefits later. So I think that was one strategy. It's one strategy that I took away from her, even when I became a department chair, was that, you know, in the face of a donor insulting me and my field to my face, I had to think, okay, I can't tell this woman off, though I want to, but I have to think about what my students would lose if I don't, you know, kind of play the game. And so Claudia Hampton taught me that because, you know, I was kind of brought up in the Black radical tradition. You speak, you know, you clap back when someone insults you. And I found myself thinking, oh, I got to think about the long term.
And that's a perfect segue for us to talk about how your book speaks to current day progressives and radicals. Obviously, you know, we're in the midst of campus protests going on and protests around graduation, and there's a lot of people taking direct action. What does this book have to teach young radicals and progressives about making change?
You need both radical activists on the outside and you need liberal insiders on the inside. They have to speak to each other and talk to each other in order to move, you know, toward, you know, achieving your goals. It can't be one or the other. It can't just be holler, tear things up and scream and demand without someone on the inside working on the inside to say, you know, actually, this is why this is important, you know, and so you need a both and strategy instead of an either or strategy.
And how do you talk to, you know, younger generations about this topic?
Yeah, so I think one thing that has been that I have been able to do, at, you know, in teaching in the university level is, one, I try to stay current with what young people are listening to, looking, consuming. You know, so I think that that's one, so that I can use that as a stepping stone for conversation, but also to say to them, look, this is your goal. If your goal is to get more, let's say, more students of color into the university, what are the steps? How can you break this down into manageable steps? What are the things that you need? And you know, sometimes they'll say, well, we just need to go up to the president's office and demand. I said, yeah, but, you know, things roll back downhill, the nicest way to put it. And so there are steps to getting students admitted into the university before you get to the president. So why don't we, I'll help you help explain to you how the system actually works. And then you can see where your interventions can help. You know, so making sure they have an understanding of how the institution works is important. And so, you know, offering to help them understand that and say to them, like, look, I know you want to have, you got 10 demands. The university is always going to go for the lowest hanging fruit. What's going to be the easiest? So why don't you cut that big old list and get down to the most essential things that you need and you want? And then it, you know, sitting down and negotiating with, you know, those things and asking for a timetable. There's nothing wrong with asking for that, but you might not be here because you might have graduated by the time things actually happen. Most change in universities take about 20 years.
And yeah, they're just, and most students hopefully are there for only a couple years.
Yeah. So if you want something to change in an institution, you have to understand how it works. And so, you know, using their pop culture references, that sort of thing. That's how I start, yeah. You know, and then go from there is just to explain the reality of the situation. And I think what a lot of young people want is to be respected for their opinions, you know, and that someone is going to listen to them, not being ready to like respond to them and tell them why they're wrong, but to listen. I like to call it listen with your whole face, yeah. You know, like hear them and understand how passionate they are about these particular issues. But when you're doing their little kid kind of talk, you automatically lose them.
No way. And this is something, at least in the K-12 world, that I say a lot to people is that just remember, we're public servants and our public are these students and these kids. And so, you know, they're the ones using the service. And so they have the best understanding, you know, for maybe how the service is not working for what their goals and needs are. And so, you know, obviously we can provide insight and understanding and knowledge, but we need to listen to them as, you know, in the same way, if you're opening a business and your customers are having a bad experience, you want to know that in order to change things to make it meet their needs. Now, this podcast is about the history of California. And I'm curious about how this writing this book has changed both your perspective on the CSU system, but also California history.
Yeah, so I've come to appreciate the CSU in writing this book. One, it's a massive system, and to hold 23 campuses together under the mantle of one system is pretty remarkable. And at any given moment, the CSU is educating 500,000 students per year. So we educate the lion's share of students in higher education in the state, you know, drivers of upward and social mobility for a lot of students, particularly first generation, low income students. And we drive a lot of economic development in particular, you know, cities and so forth. So I've come to appreciate that part of the CSU. What I've also kind of learned, I guess part of my frustration with the CSU, to be honest, is the fact that because of the way we're set up, it always feels like we're operating in a deficit. We're constantly asking for the, you know, money and support, and we're kind of given the crumbs because the community colleges are cheaper and it's quicker for students to get through. And so they get a credential fast. And so businesses give money to community colleges much more than they do the CSU. And then the UCs, because they have the research component, they get a lot of grant money. And so it kind of leaves the CSU kind of stuck in the middle, trying to figure out its identity. And I think that's part of the reason why it's seen as this kind of invisible giant, because it doesn't really have a really defined brand, I guess is the best way to describe it. To your point about California and how the book or the research fits within, can you repeat that question?
How it changed your perspective on the history of California?
Yeah, so I think that California, what it did, it crystallized for me the myth of racial liberalism in California. You know, I knew it was a myth on a kind of surface level, but when you start to get into the weeds of how this policy, particularly with affirmative action and the resistance to it, even if the resistance wasn't super loud and vocal like we might see now against, you know, DEI programs, the silence is to me as violent in a lot of ways. So it did change my perspective in terms of understanding really California has never really been as liberal as everybody thinks we are.
Yeah. Last question before we talk about book recommendations. What would you say Claudia Hampton's legacy is and should be?
I think her legacy is that not only did she fight for implementation of affirmative action, because that's a missing point. A lot of times when we talk about affirmative action, we don't talk about the implementation. We just think the creation is done. And so she really put herself on the line, I think, for 20 years of serving on all of the committees and, you know, making the dinner and doing, you know, having a cigarette with the guys in order to move things along. And so I think her legacy is that she teaches us the importance of sly civility, you know, this idea that you enter into a space, and it's a space that is formally cut off to you, and you civilly get along with everybody in order to slyly pass resources on to other people. Now, oftentimes what happens for a lot of first time, you know, a Black first, is that there's this kind of expectation or an assumption almost that, oh, you've made it into this white space, and so now you're Uncle Tom, or, you know, you're a sellout. Well, Hampton proves that that's not the case, that she stayed connected to the Black community. That was always at the forefront of what she did, but she made sure she helped as many people along as possible. So you can do both, and you can be the Black first and not be the sellout.
To close, what are a few books either on these topics or others that you'd recommend to listeners?
Yeah, so I would absolutely recommend Black Revolution on Campus by Martha Biondi, particularly if you want to know that San Francisco State history. A critical book for me was The California Idea and American Higher Education by John Aubrey Douglas. That book really details the history of the UC system, which is important to understand why there is very little written about the Cal State system. Also, Donald Gerfs, he wrote a number of books about the CSU, but they didn't get a lot of attention. One is called The People's University, A History of the CSU. It's a massive book. It's more like an encyclopedia, but it will give you the beginnings of, it give you some reference points about the system. And I think two other books, Black Women in the Ivory Tower by Stephanie Evans, and it does not cover California particularly, but how Black women as these kind of outsiders within these institutions change them from within. And then finally, Kendra Gage's, it's her dissertation, but she's turning it into a book. It's called Creating the Black California Dream. And it's about Verna Canson and the work she did with the NAACP in California to sometimes sue cities in order to get injunctions with regards to segregation in LA Unified and San Francisco Unified School District.
Fantastic. Last question. What are you going to work on next?
My next project builds off of chapter 5 of my current book, which looks at conservative philanthropy. I've been studying conservative philanthropy for decades, but it's finally time for me to sit down and write this history. But instead of looking at just the current, I go all the way back to the change in the tax code in the 1930s and 40s. And it looks at how race and education, all of these topics get impacted by the free flow of conservative dollars.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Dr. Nickel. I really enjoyed reading your book, and I would encourage everyone to pick up a copy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.